Good afternoon, everybody. How's everybody doing? Yeah, it's nap time. Got a good lunch. As Jonah said, get some caffeine. We'll try to keep you awake through this session. My name is David Brandt. This is Jonah Luke. I'm with the customer adoption team on the product team for Office 365, focusing on identity. Jonah?
And I'm with the Windows Azure Active Directory team. I'm the former owner of the directory synchronization technologies. But I still know enough to get through the session, so.
Former as of last week.
Fine. Two weeks ago. But I'm still happy to answer all your questions and whatever comes up.
Very good. So on our agenda today, we're going to go through quite a few things. We're going to start out simple, but then we'll get into a little bit of more complex scenarios and features that are identity related. We'll start out just with an overall cursory review of Office 365 Identity Management. Have a few slides on what's new, in other words, what's happened in the last 6 months that you may not be aware of. We'll talk about directory integration, different options, common scenarios. We'll also focus on exchange best practices while we talk about those options and those scenarios. And then Jonah will dive into how synchronization works. I'll cover how single sign-on works. And then we'll talk a little bit about how multi-factor authentication works, because that's something that's new that we've brought into the product. So as you know, there's lots of identities out there, whether it's Microsoft's or the competitors' products, tons of things. But inside of Microsoft, we have multiple identity providers. And we have something called the Microsoft account. Now, being a Microsoft employee, I always thought, well, that's my Microsoft account, right? Well, not right. That's a personal or a public account that you have out there for your Xbox Live or your Outlook.com or your OneDrive for your personal files. Those are the types of identities that we use for those types of services. The focus of this talk, however, is going to be more on the organizational account, which is covered under Windows Azure Active Directory. Windows Azure Active Directory is a directory service that actually takes care of the authentication and authorization for Windows Intune, Office 365, and Microsoft Dynamics CRM, and a lot more other pieces that are coming into play. So that's going to be the focus of our talk today, is on the Windows Azure Active Directory on the organizational accounts. So it's your corporate accounts. So as we talk about this, really important, one of the things that we want to get across to everybody, if you've already got an Azure Active Directory tenant that you've created for Intune or that you've created for your application or something like that for your corporation, that is the one you should be using for Office 365, unless there's a big serious reason why you don't want to use that one and do another, because we have so many escalations, so many support calls for companies that have come in and said, you know, we use this directory name for this product, but now we want to deploy Office 365, and we've already got that, and we've already created a second one, and how do we merge the two? And a simple thing to remember is if you got one, use the one you have. That's one of the things that's going to solve a lot of problems long term. Okay. So with Azure Active Directory, the intent of what we're trying to do through our identity management processes, both with what you'll see in Password Sync and our federation services, is extending your local Active Directory that you have on premises out to the cloud for all your cloud applications, including Office 365. So we have three different main scenarios that we see that we will cover in this deck and in this talk. Cloud identities. These are the identities that you create out in the cloud only. They're not anything that you manage in your internal Active Directory environment. These are your Office 365 accounts, your Intune accounts, those types of things. Those are only managed on the cloud. So they're managed by your administrator or by you by going into the Office 365 portal or through PowerShell or some other type of interface that you have with it. But once again, these are totally managed by Microsoft in the cloud. We call those cloud identities. We have another scenario with identity management that we call synchronized passwords. Now, this scenario is when you do have a local Active Directory environment and you have a tool like Directory Sync or another third-party sync, and we also use with DirSync the on-premises password hash. Password synchronization, where we're bringing the actual hash of the password in your Active Directory environment and storing it up in the cloud to use. Now, that's not single sign-on. We call that same sign-on. Just so happens I have an ID and I have a password. They happen to be the same in both places, but they're not synchronized from that standpoint from a single sign-on process. So when we would dive deeper into single sign-on, you'll see what we're talking about here. But this is very suitable for even very large corporations. We have a lot of large customers that are using this in this area. It's simple. You alleviate a lot of the problems because you don't have a lot of on-premises servers that you have to enable this environment. In fact, we'll get into it a little bit later. You can host some of those other services up in the cloud as well. Then we also have federated identities. Now, federated identities, this is where your authentication is actually happening with your local Active Directory. And we have a trust through claims process up to Office 365 that allows you to do true single sign-on. So you are signing on with an ID and a single password, and you're getting access to your resources that way. So you're extending that way. But one thing to remember, as you move to the right of here, complexity raises. So if I'm looking to do a simple deployment, I want to start very simple. Will cloud identities work for me? If not, if I need more, will password sync work for me? And what we find as we go through this scenario, there's different reasons why you may want to choose the cloud IDs only, or password sync, or the federated IDs. Some of these main ones that you'll see are listed on this list. I'm not going to go through every one of them, but I'll pull out a couple things on the password sync side. You are using the same password to access resources on premises and in the cloud. And you don't have to go change the password in both places when your password changes, because the DirSync appliance will pick that up and will make that change for you up in the cloud. That's an important thing. You can also enforce your on-premises password policies by using this process as well. Otherwise, that's not something that you can do on that side. Now, we also introduced something last month called multi-factor authentication for Office 365, which I'll get into a little bit later. But we also support that scenario using DirSync with password sync. Now, you'll see all these other reasons why you might want to use a federated ID, which would also mean using Active Directory Federation services. They're all valid reasons, but unless you don't need to have those enabled, then I would stick with the first two areas. We find that 90% of our customers can run their business and get the functionality they need just by using DirSync and password sync in the identity management platform. Jono, any comments on that?
No, I mean, that's absolutely true. We introduced password sync June 2013, and we're about half of our DirSync customers are now using password sync. They've either switched off a single sign-on or they net new deployed using password sync. So just to your point, you know, we're seeing huge adoption. And the value is you don't have to deploy more hardware. You're already running DirSync. It's a feature of DirSync. It's a checkbox, literally, when you're setting it up. So unless you absolutely need to be in that third column, you know, think password sync.
Yep. We'll dive deeper into that in a little bit. Some things that you should know. We're constantly striving to add enhancements and features for administrators and for end users. And in the last 6 months, we've made a lot of new features and items that are available for users in Office 365. We've added support for non-Active Directory Federated Services security token service systems. So we currently support providers like Shibboleth, Ping Federate, Optimal IDM. We do have still some feature gaps, which we're working through. You'll see some of those gaps go away, such as with Shibboleth, we don't support the Link 2010 client, and we're still working with Windows integrated authentication with Ping Federate and stuff. But the important thing to understand is we are working with them, and we're also working with the standards bodies on this. We'll have a little bit more detail here for you in a second with that. We've also included in what we call the Active Authentication Service. It's a service that runs out in Office 365 on the Windows Azure platform. We've now have the ability to add multi-factor authentication for your users. So being able to not only have a username and password, but also another way of providing proof that you are who you are through your telephone. We'll go through that in a little bit here. But we've added that. Now, the important thing about it is we've added that as free. Okay, we'll go through the details and all the features that you get, with that with Office 365, but we included that as no charge with Office 365. We've also improved what's called Azure Active Directory Graph API. This is a RESTful API for programmatic access to data in Azure AD. It's a way to extend beyond just PowerShell. There's in the actual slide deck later, you'll see in the notes, once you take this slide deck home, there's a link to MSDN in there that gives you all the different ways to enable using the Graph API along with PowerShell. And even the scripting guys have got some great examples of code that they've used for PowerShell access to Office 365 and then extended it with the Graph API. So you can build custom applications. Authentication processes do a lot of work with it. So real important to know that we've done a lot of work there. We also recently, just this month, announced SAML P2O Federation with Office 365. We've added the SAML 2.0 SP Lite profile for federated sign-on. And once again, in the slide deck and the notes, we actually have the link to the actual standards that we're implementing in there so you can get the details for it. So that's actually coming online now. And this allows you to sign into Office 365 web access and SharePoint using on-premises creds, but not specifically using Active Directory Federated services. So you can use the third-party security token services with it that are using the SP Lite profile. We've also added special support for multiple Active Directory forests. We have some news coming up here around the Active Directory connector for FIM for 2010 R2, which allows us to do some multi-forest scenarios. We'll get into that in a little bit. We've also got a new announcement that we'll have here in a little bit around non-AD directories, a DirSync appliance for that. We'll let Jono dive into that. And we also, as I mentioned before, the multi-factor authentication for Office 365, we have that. And now we just recently turned on S/MIME encryption for emails through Office 365 as well. That's a feature we just turned on 2 months ago, I think so.
Yep.
So there's been a lot of work going on. We continue. We have a lot of big pipeline of items that we want to enable for you, and we continue to work on that. So those are just some things that you may not have been aware of that's happened in the last 6 months from the Azure Active Directory and Office 365 standpoint. One of the other things that's really important is it's not just a Microsoft world. We understand that. And as you saw by your partners that are down in the expo downstairs as well, they have lots of different enablers for the cloud. And we've been working with a lot of these that are focusing on the IDM side or the identity management side. We have a program now called Works with Office 365. And this is actually a program where we work side by side with them. We make sure that Office 365 works with their solutions. Support for Office 365 is through us, but the support for their solutions is done through their side. However, we add them to the program when we feel that we actually have the interoperability working that needs to be there for a good experience for your customers. So important thing is that we're working with companies like Ping Identity, Centrify, Optimal IDM, IBM, CA, NetIQ, Shibboleth. So there's a lot of action happening with that. Once again, in the notes is a link to this program on the web. You can read more about it and get all the details on specifically what each of these customers enable in Office 365 and Windows Azure Active Directory. Okay. So since it's the Exchange Conference, we want to make sure that we covered some items around Exchange and make sure that you got the good message about how best to integrate Azure Active Directory with your Exchange environments. This sounds very simple, but it's a very to-the-point thing, is pick the solution that's right for you. Now, I say that because I've seen so many solutions be chosen because it's a solution that consultant or that person knows because they've done it somewhere else, okay? It may not have been right for the customer. So do the homework. Understand what it is that you're trying to implement with Exchange and Exchange Online, whether it's hybrid, all those types of things. Make sure that you're looking through here and picking the solution that is exactly right for the customer itself. And you might learn something along the way, too. If you're not comfortable with it, there's lots of help there. Minimize your on-premises infrastructure requirements. Back to the first couple slides, cloud IDs and managed IDs with password sync really reduces the need to have extra hardware in there for Active Directory Federated Services or other types of federation services. If you don't need those, our guidance is don't use them, okay? You'll get to the cloud faster. You'll have a better experience for both your customers and for you as well. Not that there's anything wrong with using those technologies, but if you're trying to get up fast and quick and get good value for your time, take a look at that. Just managing cloud IDs and manage IDs that way. Another important thing is you don't need to use single sign-on just because you sync. A lot of people think that Directory Sync, DirSync, as you may know it, and ADFS are hand-in-hand all the time. That's not necessarily so. So just because you deploy DirSync doesn't mean that you have to do ADFS. However, if you're going to do ADFS or you're going to use some other type of federation, then we highly would like for you to use DirSync to make sure that you're using it as your provisioning tool to make sure that the items that we require from Active Directory on-premises are properly represented in the cloud, okay? So once again, you don't need to have it, but if you do, make sure you have DirSync enabled with it. That's the important thing to make sure that you have, okay? Use single sign-on only if you need to. We've said it a couple times already, but we'll keep pounding it in there. Only if you need to use it, okay? However, also think about this. Single sign-on solution doesn't constrain your sync solution. In other words, if you're going to use single sign-on, you don't necessarily have to use DirSync as well. You can use any type of synchronization system that works with Active Directory in the cloud. Some companies I've seen have actually rolled their own using PowerShell. Granted, you've got to be a guru to do that, but it's been done. We have some very large Live at EDU customers in the multiple million users that have used roll their own with the guidance of Microsoft in consulting services. You don't have to do that, but it can be done, okay? Use the simple solution. All right, you can control what objects sync into Azure Active Directory. That's one of the things that you can do. However, the important thing is right now you can't control which parts of those objects sync. So you may have a user ID, and you can control which ones and which OUs you want to have sync up, but you can't go inside that user ID and say, I only want to have these attributes up there. Right now, every attribute goes in there. However, we got some solutions coming up with that in a little bit, and you'll hear a little bit more about that. Okay?
All right. So when talking with folks like yourselves, they often ask, well, how do we get to the cloud? Right, and things to do with onboarding, as we call it. So I want to spend a couple minutes, or a couple slides actually, so more than a couple minutes, talking about the different flavors of onboarding that we've sort of seen over the past years, and hopefully share that knowledge so you can in turn apply that to deciding what you want to do. The most prevalent question is, how many tenants? What is a tenant? Interestingly enough, Exchange gives a lot of flexibility. You could have multiple Exchange organizations in your on-premises environment, right? Through mergers and acquisitions, you may actually have two Exchange organizations and decide to not consolidate them, decide to keep them as two separate orgs. And that's usually, from an Exchange point of view, the most prevalent thing customer comes in with. It's, well, does that mean two organizations, one, two tenants, one tenant? At the end of the day, I'm going to send you home with three things that should help you figure this out. Email address domains. So for example, I'm at Microsoft.com, right? Email address domains cannot span tenants. And I should put these in the slides rather than just telling you them. So email domains cannot span tenants, meaning if you have two Exchange organizations or N of them that want to be sharing an email domain, they have to be one tenant in the cloud. Something we'll speak to in the next slide is how you can bring together multiple forests and all that. So put that off the side for the moment. But email domains can't span tenancies. The second thing is you actually can't segregate Exchange administration within a tenant. So classic example, there's a school that I met with a couple of years ago where they had five campuses, right? And they wanted each campus to have their own Exchange sphere of control, their own administration. Well, unfortunately, the way that we built Azure Active Directory, you don't get segmentation within a tenancy. So I know that this can kind of come at odds. So we can definitely chat after, we'll be at the booth as well, to talk about specific cases. But that's the second principle that you have to just keep in mind. You can't put administrative boundaries up within a tenant. The third thing is, it's kind of related to the first, sign-in names. So we use the user principal name of the user. That's their sign-in name. But just like with email addresses, you can't have that sign-in name domain span multiple tenancies. And that has to go with ADFS and how we do some of the single sign-on, but that's actually a fundamental design constraint of the directory. So email domains can't span tenancies, UPN domains can't span tenancies, and you cannot segment within a tenancy. So just three things that should really put you on that track. David mentioned earlier, we support non-Active Directory sources. So with as of right now, the FIM connector, the Azure AD connector for FIM, allows you to connect to a whole wealth of LDAP directories, LDAP v3 directories, SQL, file systems, and all that. We found that actually with a lot of the educational institutions and you know, email-only shops, they really only just needed support for probably a single LDAP directory. So we're taking it one step further, and we're actually releasing for preview, don't hold me to this, in the next 2 to 3 weeks, an LDAP DirSync. Just like we have support for a single AD directory with DirSync, you can connect to a single LDAP v3 compliant directory with almost as few clicks as the regular DirSync. We need a little bit more information because we don't know much about what directory you have, what the sign-in name is. So those are necessary additional steps. But the idea was keep it simple, but it's only one directory, only one instance of an LDAP v3 directory. If you need multiple, FIM is still there. You know, that's still an option for you. And so, yeah, preview is supposed to be, it was supposed to be summer. We're trying to bring it up a little bit, a longer sort of a beta window to get more feedback. But release is still, you know, the second half of this calendar year. And as David mentioned, there's actually a bunch of different tools you can use to provision data into your tenancy. Because I own DirSync, I'm saying use DirSync. It's the simplest way there is. It takes care of all the linking between your on-premises environment and cloud. It's not messy. But you can use Graph. You can use PowerShell. In fact, some of the EDUs that we onboarded recently built their own tools, right, using Exchange PowerShell, in fact, to create those user objects and mailboxes. So it's possible. But the reality is it's a lot of complexity you now take on, right? You have to build this. You have to maintain it. And when you call support, the support boundary is you used our commandlet. Anything before that, that's on you. So that's why I'm trying to reiterate, use DirSync or the new LDAP DirSync if possible, because all that's automated for you. And then when you call in because something's not working quite right, then we can step into that much more. So kind of just going a bit deeper into what I call common topologies. So as I said earlier, a couple things about how to think about your tenancy, right? One tenant, multiple tenants. Depending on what your goal is, we actually have a solution for you. I'm trying to sell you on this. The simplest deployment is a single AD forest with a single Exchange organization in that forest, right? Single AD forest, that's straight up DirSync. Now, you have a single AD forest, but in addition to that, you may have deployed multiple Exchange organizations as separate resource forests, as we call them in here. And so, depending on what your goals are, you may want to retire all those Exchange forests, move them to the cloud. We like that, right? Come use our cloud, get everyone up there. And if it's the case that you're looking to get rid of those resource forests in the long term, on the next slide, I'll actually walk you through a pattern where you don't have to deploy FIM. You can deploy DirSync with a little bit of trickery in there while you're migrating people up into the cloud. So hold me accountable to that, because that's the next slide. You could also have multiple AD forests. These are multiple user account forests. They're login forests, right? Your users are account enabled. They're signing in there. And then you also have multiple resource forests, right? A plenty of Exchange for organizations that will stay around for a long time. This is squarely our multi-forest deployment scenario. Therefore, FIM with the AAD connector is your solution. That technology is fully GA'd. So it's out there, it's supported, and it's fully documented on how to do that. In fact, some of the stuff coming from my team in the next month or so is going to make it easier for you, makes deployment easier. We're releasing a revision of the sync engine, which has really just brought the simple concepts to light and put a lot of the details lower in. So hopefully you're going to see improvements on top of what is already out there. As I mentioned before, we have support for a single LDAP directory. The reality is if you have LDAP, you're not likely to have Exchange. So that's kind of why we just say, you know what, just go with the LDAP DirSync. That's your user provisioning now into the cloud where you can light up Exchange Online and all that. Notice that we've purposely left out other mail client, mail systems and all that. We're focused on Exchange and AD here, and we can have other conversations at the booth if you need help with any of that. Now, that was all targeting one tenant, again, with those three design constraints in place. It's possible that you actually want to go to multiple tenants, right? We've seen within a single AD forest, they actually want to have two separate administrative groups, right? Two different two tenancies. So that's perfectly fine. You can do this with that Azure AD connector for FIM. And then if you're familiar with FIM sync engine, you have to create your rules and decide what goes to one and what goes to the other. That flexibility is fully there. We actually also support this with multiple dir syncs. And this is a two slides from now thing, so I'll get back to that. But again, the complexity of FIM can be reduced by using an N dir sync deployment. And I'll speak to that in a moment as well. If you have multiple non-ID directories going to multiple tenancies, FIM the connector. Again, that's full flexibility. That's the whole wealth of sort of our technologies there. And then finally, if you have a hodgepodge, right, have multiple non-AD directories and AD directories, again, that's going to be your FIM connector. Quick question.
Sure. In multiple tenancies, the global address book remains the same?
No, that's a great question. The question was, in the case where I have multiple tenancies, I've taken one set on-premises and split them, you do not have a shared GAL. That's a great point. You are segmented, right? You can only see within the scope of that tenant that you exist in. Clearly, things like GalSync are already popping in people's heads. I can see that. And so, yes, you can do certain things to make things happen. But by default, you don't get to see across tenancies in the cloud. So in the previous slide, I alluded to a particular pattern where maybe you're trying to get rid of your on-prem exchange resource forest. Right? That's why you're coming to the cloud. Although this picture depicts one particular topology, one account and one exchange, you can imagine multiple exchange forests in the same sort of layout. So in this world, what you have is you have a single login forest or account forest. That's where your user accounts actually are, right? That's what they sign in against. Our recommendation is to start, take certain attributes listed here in the login forest and push them into the resource forest. So the resource forest looks complete. The key thing about this pattern here is that you're going to make the resource forest look like the logon forest with respect to the identity information, the user principal name, the object ID, and all that. And then run dir sync from there. Then, later on, whenever you're finished migrating all your mailboxes to the cloud, you can stop that, do a one-time migration of whatever is necessary back down to the login forest, and there we go, get rid of the exchange resource forest altogether. But because you'd previously made the resource forest look like the account forest, all the information is there. Dir sync, as far as it knew, was talking to your login forest that had exchange in it. That's what we did. We collapsed them into one. And at that point, you can run your dir sync against the login forest. We definitely recognize FIM, the technology allows you to do multiple forests. It is complex, right? It takes time, you have to maintain it, and that's why we're taking approaches like this, where again, it's minimizing sort of your long-term costs, your hardware, your administration, and all that. Another scenario I promised you I'd touch on is the single forest to multiple tenancies. Examples of this are we want our legal department to be in a separate tenant for, you know, whatever policy reason. And that's fine with the constraints in mind before, right, of domains and administrative scope. So you can do this with the dir sync appliance. On the bottom half there, this is the key caveat. When you're syncing from a single on-prem forest, you have to make sure each object in there only shows up in the cloud once. There's a bunch of stuff when you're getting started in the cloud about getting your domains verified. So that won't work properly if the Jono object shows in both tenants. Only one of them will look right. The other one will kind of be this hodgepodge of values. And so that's why every object must appear at most one tenant in the cloud. You could also go the approach of FIM with the Azure AD connector. That gives you a single machine doing the work for you versus multiple dir sync machines. So you know the trade-offs there that you're more than welcome to evaluate for yourself. And in the case where you have this type of a single forest of multiple tenancies, you can actually support that with a single ADFS farm. Because from ADFS's point of view, it's just getting requests for authentication. It's talking to the right forest, and they can spit that information back out. From the cloud side, I just know what endpoint on-premises to go to, right? That's why we can support third-party STSs. Speaks a certain protocol, that's the URL, and then we send it off to there. So you can actually get away with a single ADFS farm. Come on. There we go. So, what to do if you're multi-forest? And so I'm going to try and walk through this. We'll go the single path first because that's easiest, and we can go multiple. So, clearly, how many AD forests do you have? If you're single, you're done. That was easy. If you have multiple AD forests, you have to add, I know, I love that path. That's why I say it's simple. The next one is how many forests do you have? Well, you have more than one, right? At which point, you need to ask, and we've seen this before, customers actually want to consolidate their AD forests anyways. Independent of coming to the cloud, they wanted to because it's just more overhead, right? It's more infrastructure. And it, like in the M&A example, again, you know, the mergers and acquisitions, I operate as one. I already have one AD department. So if that's something you're planning to do, go do it. The reality is you don't have to come to our cloud. That's where the multi-forest solutions come in, right? We don't want you to take on it, and I kid you not, one time with a customer, they said 6 months. The next said 2 years. So I'm like, I don't want you spending 6 months or 2 years to get to the cloud. Just use the multi-forest approach. Just use FIM in the connector, right? And so, but that's a question you should ask yourself. If it's already on your roadmap, it actually makes your life easier thinking about this from the integration standpoint. Just wait that out. But don't make it a project to get to the cloud because you don't have to. Now, and in this case, effectively, once you've decided, no, I'm not going to consolidate, I do have multiple forests, then you just simply deploy with the FIM 2010 connector, the Azure AD connector. I know it's confusing that we call it the Windows Azure AD connector for FIM 2010 R2. not only that, imagine that string in all different languages. It's kind of crazy. But the reality is, as David mentioned, Windows Azure Active Directory is the core of all of Office 365 services, right? Just like you deploy SharePoint and Exchange and Link on Active Directory, we deploy SharePoint Online, Exchange Online, and Link Online on Windows Azure Active Directory. So that's why the connector is for Windows Azure Active Directory. It's connecting to the directory, not the service. It's not to Exchange per se. It's to the underlying directory. Clearly, that's for your multi-80 forest scenarios, as well as your non-80. FIM offers connectivity to a lot of on-premises directories beyond just AD and L.v3. The list is out there on the web, and I'm happy to share a pointer with you guys if you need that. But anything that the FIM engine can connect to is fair game as a data source. Quick thing, obviously, in order to run the FIM or the connector for FIM, you have to have FIM. But to be fair, it's the FIM sync engine. So FIM has two parts. There's the sync engine, the metaverse, the connectors, all the target spaces, all that good stuff. That's what we need. In fact, that's what's in DirSync. DirSync is built on top of the FIM sync engine and the next version and all that. DirSync is a particular configuration, prepackaged with automation to deploy, but it actually is the sync engine. I sit side by side with the sync engine PMs. You don't need the portal. You don't need the FIM portal that lets you do group management, all that. That part is not necessary. You just need the core sync engine. And there's a link there for how to get the connector, the Windows Azure AD connector for FIM 2010 R2. Switching gears a bit then, how does this all work? How does sync work? This is key because, actually, let me stop and ask, how many folks in this room are responsible for deploying DirSync and the identity solution, ADFS or Password Sync? Okay. How many of you are also going to be butt online when it takes a long time for a mailbox to show up in the cloud? Probably the same hands. So the reason why I do this slide is just to give you a little bit of insight into how the system works. So that when you get asked the question of, well, why is it taking so long, or why isn't something showing up, you can fall back to this knowledge and go, oh, well, it's here, and it's not my fault, is what you can hopefully say. First of all, a core technology piece to understand here, source anchor. DirSync moves data from the on-prem AD up into the cloud. We keep tabs, almost a foreign key of sorts, between your on-prem user and the cloud user, on-prem group and cloud group, you know, mix and match, via what we call the source anchor. By default, DirSync takes a Base64 encoding of the on-prem object GUID. So that's the GUID that's automatically generated by AD when it creates the object. We Base64 encode and shove it into a string in the cloud. And from that moment on, that object is uniquely linked to the on-premises object. That's how we know when the on-premises display name changes or UPN changes, where and how to flow that up into the cloud. Now, the reason why I call this out, funnily enough, it's also in use for single sign-on. So if you picture a world where your user accesses OAuth or the mailbox, however, they're going to bounce out to ADFS or whatever STS you've deployed. At the end of that, a SAML token is generated. Inside that SAML token, well, how do I know who this is in the cloud? There's all kinds of race conditions for, you know, user principal name changing and display name changing. There's nothing solid that's guaranteed to be unique over the lifetime of that object except for the source anchor. And that's why David said that we recommend you use DirSync or one of our sync technologies to get this right. I'm not going to name the customer. They're a 1.2 million seat customer. They wrote a script because they thought they could get source anchor right. 1.2 million wrongs. And it, because of the way this is set, you can't undo it. It was a nightmare to get undone. Just case in point, right? All it takes is one oops within a script run 1.2 million times, and you're absolutely nowhere. So use DirSync if you can. It's automated. It works, right? So just a plug-in for DirSync. I'm pretty good at that now. Okay, soft match. So if DirSync created the object in the cloud, it's going to stamp that link in there, and life is good. We know exactly what object on-prem and cloud match. Well, what if you created an object in the cloud first? If you guys were at Jeff's session before for Fast Track, I think he actually touches on some scenarios where you might create a user in the cloud first, try some stuff out, right? Minimize your investment to try things out. So that's when soft match comes into play. So picture you just signed up for Office 365, you created a user, you know, joe@contoso.com, gave him a mailbox. So Joe's happy, you know, he's using his mailbox in the cloud, all is great and good. You've sold your management on, we want to go, you know, this whole, all the way in. So you're going to run DuraSync. And you're going to set up SSO or password sync. What we do is we say, okay, well, this object's coming in through DuraSync. Does this object look like anything that's already in the cloud? So we do a best match, or a fuzzy match, sorry, I guess is the right term to use. We do a fuzzy match against what's in the cloud. To be specific, we match based on the primary SMTP of the object coming from on-premises. We match object class first, a user to user, you know, and such. But it's the primary SMTP that we use to determine, is this the same user? Because more often than not, only one human will have that email address, right? You won't have two David at Microsoft.com. And so if it's the same primary email address, chances are that's the same user. So we look for that. If there's exactly one candidate match, that must be it. If there's no candidates, we'll create a new object. And if there's more than one candidate, then something's really wrong. So we spit up and go, oh, we have a problem. But soft match is how you can move up from cloud identities, as David mentioned, into the DuraSync space. We do it automatically. There's a bunch of sort of corner cases about other email addresses that are used, but let's just keep it simple. If your primary SMTPs line up, you're good to go for soft match. Yeah?
You can do this object-based mapping even after that with an immutable ID in the Office 365 with some sort of scripts too, right? So for example, the user is already populated with some immutable ID that does not match with whatever the reason with your new object. You can still do that, right? You can pre-populate the immutable ID and then run the first thing so that you have a perfect.
So the question was, the answer is yes, but the question, sorry, was can't you manually populate the source anchor on the object so when DuraSync runs it does a 100% match? The answer is yeah, you can. You can, if you're worried about relying on this, then you could actually do what's actually quite a complicated thing, right, to be able to go through, calculate, and stamp. Again, it's just potential for human error, right? If you write the script and the script is off, then all of them are going to be wrong. That's mainly it, but you're right. You could take an approach where you pre-populate the source anchor before DuraSync. But at that point, you want to get your emails clean anyways to run DuraSync, so you know it's whichever approach is more appropriate. Yeah?
How does it handle the leaks?
DuraSync over the course of however long?
Well, yeah, does it log it and then it stays there for a while? Or
it's a great question. No, absolutely. So the question was, how does DuraSync handle deletes? If you don't mind, I'm just going to do this one. We'll come back later. Okay. So deletes happen in the on-prem AD, right? Either legitimately or by accident. So the way that DuraSync works is we actually, and this is confusing, so bear with me. The DuraSync tool, the thing that I own, calls the DuraSync control in AD and says, hey, what's happened since the last time I ran? And then that replays some order events. One of them could be a delete. I deleted user X. DuraSync will actually propagate that delete to the cloud. But all the services, including Azure Active Directory, have built what we call soft delete, or the recycle bin in the cloud. And so for 30 days after a deletion happens in the cloud, that object, that mailbox, sits in the soft deleted state. So if on-premises someone goes, oh, I didn't mean to delete that user, and the user's recovered, DuraSync will actually automatically recover that user in the cloud as well. So it's basically the same as what recycle bin in 2008 R2 gave you, right? We automate that all the way through. And just for clarity, it'll sit there for 30 days. After 30 days, it's gone. But at least in that time, right, someone can't access their mailbox. Like, what's going on? If you undo that on-premises, the same thing will happen in the cloud. And sorry, if you wouldn't mind just waiting till after to get the other question. So user provisioning, how does this actually flow? On the far left, you have your on-premises Active Directory, Windows Server Active Directory. There's a blue box in there, and I realize it's missing text. That should say the DuraSync machine. That DuraSync machine and the arrow that should be there should point to the DuraSync front ends. That's the front ends that we host in our data center that your DuraSync tool will talk to. That DuraSync front end does a bunch of stuff. But suffice it to say, there's a set of logic that's evaluated every time an object comes up. The softmatch stuff that I referred to is one example. We also impose certain data requirements. For example, sign and name is user principal name. We do not allow the same sign and name on two different users. So that type of logic is encompassed in what we refer to here as the workflows. It's a common set of libraries that are applied across the board. David mentioned earlier, you can use Graph and PowerShell to create objects inside Azure Active Directory as well. You can create cloud IDs through the admin portals, the Office 365 admin portals. All of these different sort of interfaces leverage that same logic. So what'll happen is we'll do some evaluation. This object looks good, this object looks bad. And then if it's good, we'll put that into your Azure Active Directory tenancy. That is your tenancy. Again, that's that security boundary. You can't see across boundaries, but you also can't segment within. That's the first hop in. After that, the data needs to go out to the services. In this case, Exchange Online is the service we'd probably be talking about, right? There's a subsequent process that we call forward sync, but it's effectively moving your data, your customer data, into the appropriate Exchange stamp, the forest where the mailboxes actually reside. There's additional logic inside there. That's why there's the little cogs for some validation that they also apply. I mentioned a couple slides ago, you can create users directly in Exchange via Exchange PowerShell, right? And so while we have softmatch on the DuraSync front ends between your on-premises environment and Azure AD, well, Exchange Online also has some validation to join if you did certain things there. So that's kind of the second hop, getting data from our directory, the Azure Active Directory, into Exchange Online, or OneDrive, or Windows Intune, you know, choose your pick. All the services are built the same way. But hopefully that'll just help you understand a little bit why sometimes you're like, it's been 5 minutes, where is this at? Or why is it taking so long, or where this error came from? It's a two-hop process for your on-prem AD into Exchange Online for that mailbox to be provisioned, or email addresses, right? I changed the primary SMTP, added an email. All that flows the same way through.
John, this is a great example of how we use federation as well, because each of these services, Exchange Online, OneDrive, Windows Intune, they have their own version of Active Directory that we've actually federated services with. So once you create the ID in the tenant, that gets pushed out through federation, and objects are created that way.
That's right. So a little more than you probably wanted to know until you get the question, and then you can go here. All right, so how sync works, carrying on. We sync almost all objects with some exceptions. Some default accounts and well-known objects we don't move. For example, there's certain accounts you created when you deploy Exchange CAS servers, right? Those well-known system objects we leave out. The next line, DirSync can be turned off, but it takes time. Just to be super clear, you have to install DirSync and run it, right? So it's running, and the idea is once it started, you don't have to worry. It'll keep running until that machine falls off the face of the earth. You can turn that machine off. You shouldn't, but you can. Just flip it off. There's actually a system level setting which says, is DirSync feeding this tenancy? As part of setting up DirSync, you have to say, I'm about to send you data from on-premises. Because in that workflow, in that one stage, the first hop, we need to know how to reconcile data, right? There's certain decisions and precedents on which changes get to come in. So the system needs to know how to handle that. So what you can do is you can deactivate DirSync. You really shouldn't. It can take up to 72 hours, if not more, because of all the data reconciliation that has to happen. And then my team gets a phone call if it takes too long. But DirSync is a long-term investment, right? You should think about, am I going to feed my cloud environment from on-prem? If so, you set it up, it's fire and forget. In fact, we will tell you by email if your DirSync hasn't run in 24 hours. DirSync runs every 3 hours. If we haven't seen you within what should have been at least eight runs, if you have no changes, it still calls home. It still says, I'm alive, I'm alive, I'm alive. So in the worst case scenario, somewhere in the last eight runs, we should have seen something from you. So at 24 hours, no DirSync call. We actually let you know it looks like your DirSync's unhealthy. You might want to check on that. That actually leads to the next one. So options that can't be changed. DirSync runs every 3 hours. There's no two ways around that. To be totally fair, it sleeps for 3 hours between runs. So if I had a huge amount of work, it took me 16 hours, which it shouldn't, but if it did, it would sleep for 3 hours and then start again. So you don't get into these weird overlapping windows. It sleeps between runs. That's the simplest way to put it. And as David mentioned, we don't currently support scoping the attributes that sync. What that means is DirSync synchronizes 159 attributes now from on-premises to cloud that are actually the full set of attributes that all of Office 365 and Azure AD services need. We've heard loud and clear from customers, I don't want to give you all my data. I only have Exchange. I only have SharePoint. I only fill in the blank, right? And so one of the big changes coming down the pipe, I alluded to a new sync engine that, or a rewrite of the sync engine. One of the core features in that sync engine is this set of buttons that says what services I've got. We're going to add to that hopefully in the future and figure out automatically what services you have so you can't do an oops and not give us enough information. But at least for now, the idea is you know what services you have and you tell us and we'll only synchronize that information. So you can't pick and choose within. We assert that, hey, if you have Exchange, I need these 62 attributes. You can't get around that. But you know what? If you only have Exchange, you don't need the other 90 plus. And then when you buy a new service, you go and you flick the switch and you add that as well. So this gives you some more control if data privacy, data sovereignty, things like that are concerns. which I know that they are for a lot of enterprises. And we actually covered the soft delete recycle bin feature already, so I'm going to flip over that real quick and talk about password sync. So it's a feature of DirSync. One quick question there. That's right.
Is there going to be anything that would allow for a dynamic distribution
list? So the question was, we don't currently, out of the box, synchronize dynamic distribution lists, and is there some provision to allow for a signal of sorts, right, that this is going to be? Unfortunately, we don't have anything planned at this time. One thing definitely worth doing is maybe offline after this, swing by to talk to some of actually David or David's folks or myself. We can try to collect some information about that. It hasn't made it onto our feature list yet. But yeah. Right, password sync. It's a feature of DirSync. DirSync used to be 9 clicks and 4 text boxes to get running. It's now 10 clicks and 4 text boxes. The last check mark is, do you want to enable password sync? That's literally it. It's a checkbox that then goes and synchronizes the password hashes. So this is the part where I'm going to geek out for a second. The password hash is the key part of this technology. We do not use a password filter DLL on your AD domain controllers. PCNS, if people are familiar with that, stuck a DLL on your domain controllers, which would intercept password changes and then shovel that off to FIM to sync to somewhere else. We don't do that. We don't want to see your passwords. So what we do is we allow AD to do its normal thing. So your password policies, everything applies, and it's actually hashed on the domain controller. When you check the checkbox in DirSync, we give that account we use a very specific permission, which allows it to retrieve the password sync the password hash, it'll rehash again, and synchronize that to the cloud. The main thing here is at no point in time does Microsoft's technology or anything we've introduced ever see the plain text password, right? There's no way for someone to put malicious software on there, and you cannot inject this hash randomly in random places to try to make stuff work. So the password hash is what we move from on-premises to cloud. And we've taught the Azure AD login path. So when you log in Office 365, that path has been taught how Windows would log in normally. So when a password is marked as synced from on-premises, we use that code path and say, oh, we'll hash it this way to see if this is the right password. If it's not, then we apply a different algorithm. Just want to make sure that was clear, because I've definitely heard concerns, which is fair, about how password sync works. And it runs every 2 minutes. Although DirSync runs every 3 hours, password sync runs every 2 minutes. And the next question someone's going to ask is, why can't you make DirSync run every 2 minutes? And that's because there's a totally different pipe. The pipe we saw for how things flow, that's the DirSync pipe. Password hash sync is a very specific point-to-point and just shoves it right into the credential system. So it's just a different path overall. Yep. So that's a great question. And the answer is actually we can still password sync against that. Because what you can do as part of your interforce replications is move passwords within your environment. It'll still be saved as a hash. So we can still sync that hash up to the cloud. The thing that you mentioned is key in that pattern. There's a white paper published, and we can make sure you get that link. It's when you're synchronizing the account enabled status, you know, the user account control, you have to make sure that goes up as enabled. So the two are still sort of separate, but they have to come together correctly. Thank you. Okay, so with password sync, your on-premises password policies apply. And a key thing, your passwords that are synced never expire in the cloud. Why? Well, because your on-prem password is actually the master. We're just synchronizing it for you in the cloud. So your password could be expired on-premises, but you could be what we call the road warrior, you know, out there for months at a time and your on-prem password's expired. You can still use that password to log into the cloud. And got good news on the third bullet point. Right now, we only synchronize passwords for managed users. Meaning when you set up Azure AD, you have a bunch of domains. Some of them can be set up for SSO. Other ones are cloud login. Up till, what is it right now? It's 4 o'clock. Up till about 8 hours ago, you could only synchronize for managed users. We just deployed the server-side fix. Passwords will now synchronize for federated users as well. That said, some of the pieces you need to make it all work and tie it all together, that's coming later this week. But we can now synchronize passwords for federated users, meaning you don't have to deploy a two data center solution for your single sign-on anymore. If you really want some of the goodness of SSO, you can deploy a smaller deployment. And then we have a whole article about what to do here. Later on, if your SSO solution's out of commission for some reason, right? Load balancer blows up or whatever that is, switch over to the synchronized passwords. So it's sort of a low-cost alternative to your single sign-on experience.
How many people like that? That's, I know from an architecture standpoint.
So that means we get 5.0s in the review
yes,
now, right?
That's,
I knew I would.
That's real-time data from Jonah Lewis.
That's right. As I got confirmation 2 hours before this that we got it deployed. So, yeah. That's a great question. So the question was, I positioned it as it's a failover for your SSO. Can you switch back? Absolutely. So I don't. Real quick, I guess, what will happen is you're having your single sign-on solution work just great. Everything's fine. You're also password syncing in the background. So all your users have passwords up in the cloud. You realize your single sign-on infrastructure is unavailable, right? Whatever reason. There's a conversion process to say, go over to the synchronized passwords. Later on, as you just called out, you can still flip back. And so a decision needs to be made, because there is a 2-hour window, and I don't want to get into the details, but there's caching, obviously, at the web, where that the failover won't actually take effect yet. So the question you have to ask is, will the time it takes me to fix my SSO problem be more or less than the time it takes me to flip over and flip back? So that's all in the article that's going to be published shortly. So yeah, but that's absolutely a possibility. You don't have to move away from it forever, although you can. Like I mentioned earlier, we have a lot of customers. We track this week over week. We're looking at about 200 to 300 customers a month switching away from ADFS to password sync because it just meets their functional needs. Mm-hmm. I see a question there, and I'll keep going.
Does this mean that if you move a user from a federated domain to a non-federated domain,
your synced password will carry with them? So the question was, does this mean that if you're moving a user from a federated domain to a managed domain, a non-federated domain, will their password stick with them? The answer is it depends. If you're changing their user principal name, such that I was Jono at Contoso.com before, and I'm moving over to Jono at Fabricam.com, that password will not move with them because it's a different user principal name, right? So on premises, we don't know what happened. If you're converting a domain from federated to managed, the password will stick. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
How about for next year? I'll try and have the new PM bring you the answer you want. Okay, integration requirements. So for single sign-on, you need at least ADFS version 2.0. That's Windows Server 2008 and above. I'll just call out here, hopefully good news for some folks in here as well. User principal names aren't always using routable domains, meaning you may have at contoso.local, a company dot, well, or just company, right? No dot something. We actually have a fix coming out in about 2 weeks' time that allows you to get around that problem. So if you have contoso.local on premises, how many folks here have something like that? Ooh.
Wow.
That's more people than I thought. Okay, so more of you be happy then. So we have a solution with ADFS and the sync side, which allow you to get around that. It's using what we call an alternate logon ID. So in ADFS configuration, you say, don't use UPN, use this value instead. And there's trickery inside the claims issuance rules and our login path requires 2012 R2. Because it was actually a code fix, it's a change and all that. But again, if anyone's interested, you can find me afterwards or at the booth and I can walk you through some of those details. How do you mean by add an additional UPN?
Yeah, the attribute.
Okay. So I think what you're saying, so the question was, is that better than adding an additional UPN? The thing in reality of it is some customers can't. They've got smart cards. They have apps that require the UPN, so they weren't able to add the additional suffix and change all their user principal names. I'm sorry, that's a great clarification point. Because of those realities for certain enterprises, corporations, governments, they can't change the UPN, so that's why they would need this instead. It gives you the same functionality, though. It's functional parity. It's just a different way to approach the problem if you can't change your on-prem UPN, which is still our primary recommendation.
Right, yep.
Okay, DirSync. DirSync runs on any 64-bit OS, including Server 2012 R2. It can actually be installed on a domain controller. I don't recommend it in general, but if you have a small environment. To be fair, SBS server, right, is a single server, and that's exactly the scenario. For all types of customers, all shapes and sizes, and that's why we support that now. SQL, it runs on SQL Server 2008 R2 or above. By default, we install 2012 SP1 Express. You don't have to do anything. You get that for free. And then in terms of what it can sync from Server 2003 and above. And we support virtualization. In fact, you can deploy on Azure IaaS, the infrastructure as a service. We have a white paper out there on how to do this, what to think about when you're deploying that, considerations for having a read-only domain controller in the cloud so you have low latency between your ADFS front ends and domain controllers. All that's in that white paper there. Back to David.
Actually, that was a common topic that I talked with customers yesterday. Anybody here doing that successfully right now? running these in the Azure? Okay. It does work. It is a great option, specifically for customers that are looking to reduce that hardware footprint that they have. Okay. Good deal. So let's move on here. Single sign-on, why is it good for admins? Once again, single credential. You're not managing credentials in local Active Directory and then credentials up in the cloud and in Azure Active Directory. The credentials are stored on-premises. Single place to manage your policies, and in other words, your workstation restrictions, those types of things, and your identity platform, there is your Active Directory. So that's the key thing for admins in this area. Why is it good for users? I've got a single credential. Once again, I don't have to memorize two things, but once you usually don't have to if you're using password sync as well. But this makes it one more step easier. In most cases, I don't have to re-enter my credentials more than once, and I'll talk about that in detail here in a second. But even if I am, it's usually the same credential, which is good. So let's talk about those scenarios. Single sign-on experiences. So the way to look at this slide is actually from the columns going down. So the first one is the rich applications that use the sign-in assistant. And we have the different types of scenarios we've been discussing, cloud IDs, password sync, and then single sign-on. So if you're using these rich applications, such as Link Online, Office subscriptions, CRM Rich Client, or Office 2003, if you have a cloud-only ID, then your username and password is there, and it's managed in the cloud only, okay? So you don't have the two integration piece here. But what if you add DirSync and password sync to the area? For these applications, you're actually using your local AD credentials for your authentication that you have in this. If you're using single sign-on, there's no prompt, and that's the difference here. So you're not prompted for that. We'll walk through that here in a little bit. But you're using your AD credentials, and in those applications, you can save those credentials. So the user can click the little button saying, save my credentials, or remember my sign-in, that type of thing. So that's in the rich applications. If we look at the web clients, so this is clients that are older or they're the online clients. So if we have Office 2010, Office 2007, SP2 with SharePoint Online, Outlook Web App, those types of applications, these are your web browser interface. If you're using your cloud IDs, once again, you're just using authenticating username and password, that's the prompt, and it's your online ID. However, if you're using password sync and single sign-on, or same sign-on with password sync and DirSync, then you're prompted for username and password, and you have you're using your AD credentials to do that. If you go into the single sign-on with IDs, then once again, you're just prompted for your username, and it redirects you at that point. Key thing here is that you can remember the last user. That's where you have the little button there. So a lot of times when I sign in and using OAuth for Microsoft, the second that I type in david.brand@microsoft.com, it redirects me. I don't even enter my password at that point. Okay, it redirects me to the STS endpoint that we have at Microsoft. So that's what we're talking about with that piece. If we look at mail clients, this is where it gets a little bit different. And Outlook and those types of mail clients, Office 2010, 2007, ActiveSync, Entourage on the Mac platform. If you're using cloud IDs, once again, the common thing here is you're prompted for username, password, and your online ID is a credential that's being observed. However, with password sync, you get prompted for username and password, and we're using your AD credentials for that. Single sign-on, username and password, AD credentials. You can save the credentials, and once again, you click on the button, and it will save, the application will save the credentials for you, and present those credentials again until the token doesn't work anymore. So, okay. This is just an example for you later. I'm not going to go through all this, but this just shows the different client to endpoints usage. We've got a boundary in the middle there. That white dotted line is a corporate boundary. So when you look at your clients, whether it's Outlook 2010 or 27 or ActiveSync device or Link 2010 or Office subscription or OWA on their corporate boundary, you can see the endpoints that they actually get redirected to for the authentication flow. And if you look out and a customer's user is outside the corporate boundary, you can see the flow there as well. Notice that Exchange Online does do some proxy points here with the active authentication for you. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but this is just kind of a reference for you later if you want to go back and review it. All right, let's talk about some just basic integration flows. This is for the web profile, so this is for the browser. On the left-hand side, we have the customer sitting in the corporate network on a machine and wanting to connect to Microsoft Online Services and get access to Exchange Online or SharePoint Online, something in that scenario. So they go out and they type in the URL, or they get redirected to the URL. Exchange Online, SharePoint Online doesn't believe them. I don't know who you are. Who are you? Can you prove it? Goes out to the authentication platform. Authentication platform says, yeah, you know what, I'm not quite sure, but I do know where you need to go ask, because you have a federated identity set up with us. So we're going to send you off to your ADFS server. It's going to get its claim. And once we get that claim, we're going to present it back to the online services for the authentication. This is the Azure Active Directory. And we get our token. And we come back to the application, and we get our access to the flow that way. So that's browser-based authentication, just basic flow. Gives you an idea of how that works for ADFS in that scenario. Okay, let's mix it up a little bit here with the rich clients. So in this scenario, we have a link client, and we're trying to get to link online. This is a little bit different scenario to where we request access. Link knows to go and get the authentication first in this scenario. Comes back, is redirected to its claim security token service, which is ADFS. Gets its claim, comes back in to prove who it is. Comes back down to the client, and then the client goes back out and gets access to services this way. And you get your sign-on for Link. So this is the rich client scenario. Okay. And one last, and this is Exchange. As you know, Exchange does things just a little bit different. When have they not? Okay. I grew up doing Exchange, so I love it. So not cutting it down there, but this is something, the scenario that we all work with an Outlook. So this is Outlook in the ADFS environment in the authentication process. So user tries to go to get to Exchange Online, comes back, says, I'm not sure who you are. And Outlook provides it the credentials, because you get prompted for credentials there, or they've been saved. Now, in this scenario, here's where it's different. We stop the communication back with the client. Exchange does a proxy and goes up to the authentication platform, says, hey, I'm not sure I know who this is. Who is this? And, well, we don't know, but we know who can tell us who it is. So we'll send them over there. We'll get our claim. Bring it back in. Authenticate. Yes, you have access. And here's what you can do with this claim. And the user then is using Outlook. That is the flow for authentication in those different scenarios. I've got a question in the back. Question is, how long does the claim last between Exchange and the platform? I don't know the exact answer. I know in some scenarios it's configurable. I know you can do that on.
Yeah, I think we're ratcheting down on that. I don't have the exact answer. Yeah. It's less than a day.
Mm-hmm. 10 hours?
Is it 10 hours now?
Yeah, 10 hours. Okay. Very good. Okay. Yep. It is an active client. It's not rich in the scenario. It does its authentication process a little bit different. Now, that's going to change in the future.
Okay.
Yeah. We've got some changes coming in with the next rev of the Outlook client. So. Yeah, absolutely. You brought up a great point. 10 hours is on that. Note that those tickets are usually their expiration policies are set by the services. So some of the services may have different ones. So Exchange Online, if you're using it, and you're using PowerShell commands to go to Exchange Online, there are different timeout, whether you're working against that or working against SharePoint, et cetera. So that 10 hours may not apply to all the services. I wanted to point that out. I helped the customer identify why some of their scripts were running very long, and then all of a sudden they had to provide credentials again. So, okay.
We don't have a slide for that.
I don't have one in this slide deck. One probably exists, but not in this slide deck. Yeah.
We could whiteboard it if you want to come to the booth.
Yeah. Okay. One other thing to consider with Federation and ADFS is you do have the ability to do what's called client access filtering. This is the enablement of blocking external access for Outlook scenarios. So this is where you can come in and you can block external access. You can turn off specific mail clients, ActiveSync, you know, through the protocols, POP IMAP. And you can allow external access to web applications, so you can turn that on and off. This does require the ADFS proxy to be able to do that scenario. And then you can combine some of the above. You do have some limitations here. You can't turn off Link right now at this point, or the Office subscriptions. So these rules will break that type of a scenario. These are enabled through the client issuance rules and ADFS 2.0 going forward. Some great articles online about how to configure those. One question over there.
I know there's been a few teething pains with the Link 2013 client authentication. Microsoft kind of has been issuing, hey, apply this to the main user registry key. Has this issue been addressed by Microsoft?
I'm not aware of it.
Unfortunately, I'm not aware of that. We might have to go talk to someone from the Link team to get more details on that. Apologies.
Yeah, come down and see us later. We'll try to find somebody to give you that answer. Question there?
More of a statement, really. There's one thing to point out. If you're using the MFA with the rich clients, the app passwords mitigate all of your attempts to block external access to
ADFS. I'm actually going to cover that in the next two slides. Yeah, the question was, or it was a statement about some of those breaks if you use something called app password, which we'll get into. All right, multi-factor. How many folks are using multi-factor for Office 365? Okay. Multi-factor for other applications? You know, there was many, many, many applications I know and customers that work with that used various types of this. With Microsoft, we have... In Azure Active Directory, we have two different scenarios that we're going to cover here. We have some authentication scenarios using multi-factor. One is federated users. And the key thing here is if you're using Federation and you're using Office 365, then you just need what's called the multi-factor authentication for Office 365. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that on the next two slides. But that's a key thing. That's only if you're a federated user and you're only trying to access Office 365 resources. If you use multi-factor for your own application or other applications that you have that are also using Azure authentication, then you need to use what is called Azure Multi-Factor Authentication Server. And we'll actually clarify that in a little bit here, but that's a key thing. And then we have a scenario that's hybrid. This is on-premises server applications that require multi-factor. Because with Azure Multi-Factor, you can actually have on-premises solutions that are using the multi-factor authentication process. However, it does require the on-premises server for that. We'll go through that in a little bit. And then another scenario is called App Password for Administrator. It essentially breaks. App Password is kind of a temporary workaround that we have that allows you to enforce an application to come back for another factor of authentication. Right now, that authentication is a string that we present to you in a web browser that you can actually then put in your authentication credentials prompt when you fire up Outlook or something like that, and then that is the credentials that it uses for its second factor. It doesn't overwrite what you use for your username and your normal password, but it gives you a little 2FA. That is a short-term solution. There'll be some more work going on that to resolve that long-term. Yes?
Real quick, do you know if that meets up with CGIS?
I don't know that. Yeah. Question was, does it meet up with CGIS? That'd be something we could research for you. The key here is for administrative accounts, that doesn't work. So you need to create a service account that you're going to use, or don't use app passwords in that scenario. Same with PowerShell. If you're an administrator and you want to use multi-factor, create a second service account that you're going to be using to do that work, and then multi-factor will work. Now, what's multi-factor presented to you as? Well, when you set this up by users, you have some choices. You can have individual ways for individual users. You can have a mobile app, so on your Windows phone or other phones that are out there, there's actually an application in the store that you fire up when you get prompted to. It gives you a code, and you plug the code in, and off you go. That's using the mobile app. With a phone call, you actually get a telephone call from our system. This is using the phone factor back end that we acquired several years ago. And you get the phone call that prompts you to do a button on your phone as your second authentication. You can also use text messages as well. You get a text message, and it will give you a code that you then plug into your credentials as you go through here. So fairly easy to set up. I was on the beta team that tested this with my own clients and stuff like that, and it worked. It just had to be in a scenario where I could get access to my phone. And sometimes if you're in a data center, you don't have phone access. Guess what? You can reroute it to another phone, which is good. Now, I don't expect you to go through every piece of this, but if you're wondering, what do I get in Office 365 with multi-factor authentication? We just announced this in February that we've turned this ability on for everybody, and you can see that you have six major things that you get for free out of the box here with it, with Office 365. Administrators can enable and force MFA to end users, of course, mobile app, use phone call as second authentication factor, use SMS as second authentication factor. App passwords, we include this as well for non-browser clients for Outlook and Link. And then also you get the default Microsoft greeting if they make the phone call. Now, if you use what's called Windows Azure multi-factor authentication, this is the higher end, and you can upgrade from the normal version that you get with Office 365. You can just enable this through the licensing. You get a lot of other features that you can have here. One of the more important ones that we see is if you're using multi-factor for on-premises applications, this is the product that you need to be able to include that with that. You can also then create custom greetings and those types of things as well. So you also get access to the SDK that you can use for your custom applications to enable multi-factor for it. So there'll be some more announcements about this coming out soon, but for right now, this is what's available, and it's a pretty solid product. It's working well. Yes?
Is it available with clients here, V1 and V3, or just the three licenses?
The question was, is it available through plan? Which plans? And I think it's the everything except for the dedicated plan, and I don't remember the number for that, but and I think the government as well, the government plans. But you can get it. It's on by default. You enable it as an administrator for your users. So, okay, Jono.
We have a minute to spare.
Yeah, we have a minute to spare.
Yeah. There are some questions, I guess, actually that came up earlier. Do you want to just catch those now, maybe?
Yeah.
All right.
One most important thing. Once again, if you're new and you're trying to do a new deployment to the cloud, Exchange migration to cloud, keep it simple. Don't take the hard path. Keep it simple, because we're keeping those avenues open for you for more flexibility down the line. Okay.
Yeah.
It was a dumb question. It's just a test me all the time. It's not a new thing. When it makes a soft match, does it then put the.
The question was, once a soft match during DuraSync has happened, does it stamp that GUID, the source anchor? The answer is yes. Because then it's exactly the same as if DuraSync had put it there in the first place. Just to add to that, what we'll actually do is we will overwrite the cloud values with what came from on-premises. Because in that case, on-premises is authoritative and correct.
Which is fine. It's just nowhere near the slides where we were talking about, I didn't say that.
I've never been asked that, so I've never answered it. But yes, we will stamp it for permanent record, just as if we created it by DirSync.
It came up for an executive who got here with her name and her primary email address.
Yeah, exactly why we have source anchor versus an email, yeah.
Before we take more questions, I want to thank everybody for showing up today.
Yes, thank you so much.
Hopefully this enabled you to have some better decision process. We appreciate that. There's a microphone here if you'd like to come up.
Yeah, we've got a little bit more time until we get kicked out, so.
Jono, did you say you were going to actually provide a link for actually using password sync and federation as well?
I'm sorry, I was going to.
Were you guys going to provide a link for the instructions on using password sync and federation?
Yeah, so that's, I have to publish that still. Okay. It'll probably come later this week. There will actually be blog posts about it by Paul Andrew and folks. So there'll be all kinds of links to that at that point, but there will be a wiki on how to do exactly that.